This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash is Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Louise Hill. Louise is co-founder and CEO of GoHenry, a brilliant digital platform that's on a mission to make every kid smart with money. It is a big winner in my household. Louise, thank you so much for being here today. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, thank you for being one of our customers. So GoHenry, prepaid debit card and financial education app designed for kids age 6 to 18. And as you said, a very simple mission to make every kid smart with money. We pioneered the category in financial education when we launched back in 2012. And we provide parents with tools to help kids learn about money by earning, saving, spending responsibly, giving, and more, all with parental oversight. And very much rooted in our mission, about a year ago, in fact, just over a year ago, we teamed up with the US fintech Acorns to allow us to deliver financial wellness to the whole family and provide customers with an opportunity to manage money through all of life's many stages. And to give you an idea of size, between us, that's GoHenry and Acorns, we have nearly 6 million members across 5 different countries. That's the UK, the US, France, Spain, and Italy at the moment. And over 2 million GoHenry members in the UK. And I always think this is an amazing thing when I say it, but we really are the only app in the UK to offer both the theory of money management and the practice with the debit card all in one place. So we have a Visa debit card that with parental limits that parents can set for each child. And we have money missions, which are in-app gamified money lessons designed to teach children and promote better financial literacy. They cover a full curriculum in line with the National Education Guidelines. They've been developed with teachers and financial experts and cover a huge range of topics: money basics, earning, saving, borrowing, credit, investing money safely, lots of things like that. So yeah, in summary, that's us. And my favorite stat, 1 in 5 children aged 10 to 12 in the UK has a GoHenry card.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Including my first daughter. My second daughter is counting down until it's her turn, and we can't wait to get her GoVivi card. But Louise, what you've just shared is absolutely incredible. I mean, first of all, and I've been aware of GoHenry for a number of years, but I don't think even I had appreciated that you've been around since 2012.
Yeah.
But those numbers are absolutely staggering, and you're just so calm and unassuming. And
you know the swan analogy. It's all going on under the surface.
Yeah, because you've reeled off those outstanding stats just so easily. But what magnificent accomplishments, and particularly given, you know, as you say, you were first in class, and now I know that, you know, when competitors see success in a certain area, then you start to attract. So I often say it's actually a good thing when there's competition, because it means that there is definitely a market for it. There is appetite for this proposition. And I think prior to you recognizing, gosh, this is a problem and I want to do something to resolve it, I wonder quite how many other people had identified similar issues in their own households and just had no idea what to do about it. So I suppose one of my first questions is, can you share for us your journey? What was the catalyst for you in saying, you know what, we really need to do something about financial education, financial literacy for children? Of course, it's something that's particularly close to my heart with Cash is Queen. But there's a difference between, you know, having an idea, as we say, and actually mobilizing and doing something about it. What was the motivation for you?
I used the phrase a couple of weeks ago, I blame my kids. It was literally my kids standing in front of me every week on a Saturday morning, because that was the deal in our house, with their hands out, expecting pocket money. And it was at the time, and this is immediately going to date it, when iPods were having their moment. Remember them? Yeah, remember them.
Wow, loved my
and
iPod.
And my kids had been lucky enough, I think their aunt and uncle had bought them the little mini iPods for either a Christmas or birthday. And I know many parents have made this mistake. Foolishly, I'd given them the login to my iTunes account. And they were having a great time. They were downloading music, thoroughly enjoying it, but without any concept that that was spending money. And I was trying to figure out, how do I make them understand that that's money? And I always think this is very telling about my character, but I started to print out the invoices that iTunes used to send you for every download. And then I'd use a magnet and stick them on the fridge. And on a Saturday morning, we were having the conversation about, so, you know, child number one, you would normally get £5, but you've spent £4.20 on iTunes this week. So guess what? You only get 80 pence. And, you know, I've joked many times about, and mum's the bad guy again, but I was trying to get them to understand the consequences of those decisions. And I started talking to other parents about it. And one of the main conversations about it took place standing at the side of a school football match where my son was playing and talking to other parents. And the point you made is absolutely right. All these stories came out from the other parents. It seemed like everybody had their own story. It was either, you know, somebody's daughter had spent a couple of £100 buying, I don't know what, scrunchies for their little pony's hair online, or somebody had spent money buying their way up different levels in a game, an online game. One of my favourite ones, somebody's son had spent £600 on eBay on what he thought was a model car, which turned up on a flatbed truck outside her house. It wasn't a model car at all. That's a true story.
Oh my gosh.
So we were all having those problems. And children were quite clearly interacting online, spending money online. But there was nothing out there. And so myself and two other parents who happened to have kids at the same school at the same time, we started to meet on a Thursday night at an Indian restaurant in the town we live in Lymington, just to bounce ideas around about this and try and figure out, hang on a minute, can we do something about it? We knew there was nothing else out there that we could find. And that was where it came from. And we wanted to create a service really for parents, but fundamentally to help parents empower their children with the freedom to use and understand money and the confidence to do it in a safe environment, which was becoming more and more cashless. And yeah, that's how it started.
I mean, I love that. There are so many themes that you've outlined in that response. But I mean, let's taking them in reverse. I mean, your point about this shift towards us becoming more cashless. And I read a report in the FT that talked about the huge decline in cash circulation and what that means for financial inclusion in certain quarters and communities. But certainly when it comes to our children, you know, we have a generation of young people that have grown up without ever really seeing mom or dad or granny or grandpa or whoever, you know, counting out cash or, you know, having to pay a milkman or having to, you know, go into a shop and only be able to spend cash. You know, we're very much a kind of tapping culture, a contactless culture. And I often use the example of being out with my young daughters in London and them just having an expectation that, you know, we could go into any shop at any time and mom just had the means, you know. And sometimes I would say, you know, well, mommy hasn't got her purse, and they'd go, well, why can't you just use your phone? And they were able to say that to me as soon as they were able to speak, really. They would say, well, mommy, I want a lollipop. And I'd say, well, I haven't got any cash. And they'd say, well, just use your watch or use your phone, because, you know, they just have this implicit assumption that money is this ethereal thing. So one of the things that we love most in our household is the way that GoHenry helps children to, particularly in this cashless society, to understand and appreciate the movements of money, even from, you know, if you've got £10 and you spend, then now you've got £5 and maybe you'll make a different decision now, and really start to understand the correlation between the things that we want and that kind of immediate versus deferred gratification. If I wait, what happens? And if I buy it straight away, what happens? So I think that's really powerful. But Louise, you've talked about, you know, the app really being developed, you know, originally in your minds, you were trying to solve a problem that yourself and other parents faced. And that, of course, you know, one of the things that we love most is that children, you know, my daughter's got the app downloaded on her iPad and she absolutely loves it. I mean, I'm going broke trying to keep up with the money missions. She loves those money missions. So can you just talk me through, or talk us through, how that evolved in terms of the evolution of the app, starting from a perspective of we are solving a problem that parents face, but then recognizing we have to make this something that kids are going to want to engage with too, otherwise it's not going to work.
Yes, absolutely. I think that was always clear from day one. It's no good building something for parents if the children don't want to use it, because they're not going to use it, and then the parents are going to they're not going to find it useful because the children aren't engaging. So I think we knew from day one we had to build it in a way that the kids wanted to use it too. And it's probably worth saying, you know, when we talk about kids and teens, we actually treat our kids and teens in kind of three distinct age groups. So we have the 6 to 10-year-olds, there's 10 to 14s, and then there's 14+. So one of the things is if you join GoHenry, if you come and work with us, one of the things we talk about is how many audiences do you think we have? And most people say two, parents and kids. And like, no, got news for you. Because the way you talk to a six-year-old, the language you use, even the imagery that we use on the app and the card choices that a six-year-old chooses are very different from a 15-year-old. So we have to adapt both the product and the language and the messaging and all of the communications and the designs to suit the different age groups. And we've grown that differentiation as we've been around longer. And then the step that we took, I'm trying to think how many years ago it is now, probably 4 years ago, was to really embed overt financial education into the app. So when we started, it was a debit card with parental controls. And I've always been a great believer in learning by doing. So a lot of the learning in the app came from real life experience. You get your pocket money, it shows up on your app, you spend your pocket money, you get a little notification to tell you you've spent it, how much you've got left. You put some in a savings pot, it tells you how much you've got in the savings pot, it tells you how long it's going to take you to reach your savings goal, all learning by doing. What we added about 4 years ago with Money Missions was the overtly educational side of it. And it's been amazing how that's been received. So we have three groups of Money Missions, one for each of those age groups that I mentioned. And they differ wildly both in look and feel and in content, because again, what you teach a 6 to 8 year old is very different to what you teach a 15, 16, 17 year old. And it's been really interesting to see how kids engage with that. So some absolutely love working through the levels and kind of taking it as a challenge and doing every single money mission and working their way through, getting their XP points, going up the next level, getting their certificate, moving on to the next grade. Others just dip in and out, or a certain action that they take with their money, a decision that they make with their money in the app might trigger a prompt to, well, you know, let's think about saving and trigger a money mission on saving. And it's been fascinating to see how the different groups of kids engage with it differently and how that's been received. And yes, some parents choose to incentivize their kids by paying, I suppose, a wage for working their way through money missions. Others don't. It's, you know, it's there for the parent to decide what works for them, really, and what works for their child.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the, among many other things, but one of the features that we love most in our household, the flexibility and, you know, the ability that we have to set controls and set the levels in such a way that suit us and suit other things that we are trying to teach, other lessons, and how those money lessons are integrated with broader life lessons. Because ultimately, that's what we are trying to normalize, that money shouldn't be a separate, terrifying thing or something that people associate with, oh gosh, I'm terrible at math, so therefore I don't know anything about money. And often both of those things are untrue, but it's really just about, you know, normalizing that conversation. But you said something really interesting just then that I want to explore with regard to how people learn. And of course, there are some people that are more experiential learners and those that, you know, can, you know, like myself, I would much prefer to read a book and, you know, find out what I need to know from that book and then move on. When it comes to financial education, is it something, and of course, you know, we've seen the evidence with GoHenry, and you've talked about how you've embedded a comprehensive program of financial education into the app. So do you think it's something, you know, for those people that might say it's something that you learn on the job, it can't be taught, what would you say in response to that?
Oh, I disagree with that completely. It absolutely can be taught.
And should.
Yeah, and should be taught. Well, we can come on to that in a moment. But yeah, I mean, there is an oft-cited Cambridge University study that showed children's financial habits start to be formed by the age of 7. And
wild.
You know, it is wild. But then when you think about it, they're growing up in a household. That household's way of interacting with money and talking about or not talking about money is surrounding that child. And so they start to form those financial habits. And that, for me, if we're not getting in there early and starting to teach kids early about money and opening those conversations up in the home and elsewhere, it means kids are missing out on a huge opportunity to master what we often refer to, I always bang on about, being a life skill. You know, money skills are a life skill, and those life skills influence the financial decisions you make for the rest of your life. And they actually influence your life outcomes, your well-being outcomes. They're key to unlocking a bright future for the next generation. And, you know, that can be better job prospects. It can be higher earning power. It can be better mental well-being because of the reduction in worry and money concerns. So teaching financial education from a very early age, I think, is absolutely critical. And you'll probably be aware, we've been running Make Money Count campaign and a government petition to make financial education mandatory in every primary school in the UK, which shockingly, it isn't at the moment.
No, and huge round of applause in Raincheck HQ regarding that. You know, we're big supporters of that campaign because I completely agree with you. And you're quite right that, you know, that's a study, the Cambridge study that you refer to is one that I'm very familiar with, because you know, just like anything else that our children learn by osmosis, they learn by observing, they learn by doing. But of course, ultimately, we have these mini-me's that are watching us all the time, these spectators. Yeah. And we're on stage and they're watching everything that we do and they mimic us. And I think, you know, we do them a disservice by assuming that, you know, it's for grown-ups and, you know, they'll learn about it when they're adults or they'll learn about it when they leave home. Which, you know, as I'm sure we can agree, is just simply too late.
It's way too late. It really is way too late. And if you think about when I grew up, so I was at school, oh my God, give my age away, back in the late 60s, early 70s, well, late 60s and through the 70s, you had money in your purse or your wallet. And when it was gone, it was gone. And there was not, even for an adult, there was not easy access to credit. A loan was something you had to go and negotiate with your bank manager. Nowadays, financial services are so much more complex and so much more easily available. Credit's easily available. Think about all the buy now, pay later solutions that are available on virtually every checkout basket you go through. If we're not teaching kids about those and to be confident in managing them, understanding them, and mastering them, then we're setting them up for failure.
Agreed. And that sounds like a really strong statement, but it's necessarily strong because that's the reality. I mean, when you look at buy now, pay later, and that almost leads me on to my next question with regard to some of the barriers or some of the challenges that we face in this era. You know, we've got a proliferation of different types, not just financial services providers, but the services that, you know, these different companies are offering. And imagine you're effectively sending your young person out into a lion's den. Because there are so many predatory practices out there. You know, we've got social media everywhere they turn. They are being sent things on WhatsApp and Snapchat and TikTok and all of the different platforms. And whilst it doesn't mean that every child that uses social media will necessarily fall prey to some of those predatory practices, we almost leave them with no defense, you know, when it comes to, you know, being victims of financial crime or fraud, if we don't equip them with the right education to, you know, withstand some of those challenges or at least know how to raise the alarm. So I suppose against that backdrop then, in thinking about all of the new ways that people can get access to credit, you know, or get access to, you know, banking products and services, what do you see as some of the biggest barriers to teaching young people about money, particularly in an era of, you know, we want it immediately, even with buy now, pay later, is everything is, you know, I don't want to save, I don't want to wait, I just want it today.
Yep, I've heard that once or twice. I think there are a number of barriers. One is currently lack of collaboration between the different stakeholders. I think financial education requires involvement from across the board. There is again, well-quoted African proverb that it takes a village to bring up a child. Well, I think in a similar way, we need government, businesses, industry, charities, parents and teachers all to come together because all of those organisations and individuals have a role to play in making sure that we're bringing up financially literate kids. And at the moment, there is not joined up thinking there. There are lots of individual, incredibly high quality interventions or exercises or provisions, but there isn't collaboration to bring that together, nor is there anything mandating that every child receives it. So it really is a bit of a lucky dip whether a particular child is going to receive any financial education at school or anywhere else in their upbringing at the moment. Then I am going to say insufficient support from the government. We've spent probably the last couple of years lobbying government, talking to anybody who will listen to us in government, cross-party, about the need for collaboration between government and industry to implement financial education in every school. And then there's limited resources. So there are all kinds of excellent financial education programs out there. But in terms of teachers knowing where to go to get them, having the time or the resources to implement them, parents, teachers having the expertise or the confidence to deliver them. There's all sorts of things like that getting in the way, and that really is resulting in a financial capability gap. And it costs the UK billions. It really, really does. If we come together, if we make it, we put it into schools as the really as the place where we can reach the most children the most effectively, then we can start to bridge that gap.
I mean, I completely agree with you that it requires a truly joined up approach. It's not something that can be done in silos. And we know that, you know, so much of our socialization as children outside of the family, it happens in schools. And so it's so important that, you know, every possible opportunity there is, that we make sure that there is a consistent and joined up. So it shouldn't be that children in the north of the country are getting financial education and those in the south don't, because in the end, we all converge to get, you know, on the same society, we form relationships with one another, we are working together, and we don't want this asymmetrical society in which some people are better equipped to manage their money than others. You can see the consequences, the catastrophic consequences potentially of that in years to come. But one of the things you touched on just then was about, you know, whether teachers as well as parents, whether they feel they've got the knowledge, the confidence and the competence really to teach some of these skills. What are some practical things you think families can do to start or optimize their children's financial literacy journey, particularly those that might be a bit nervous or unsure?
Having conversations in the home about money, I think, is the first one. Do you know, if I roll back 10 years, when I first started to go out and I guess pitch to people to try and raise the funds to start the business, one of the slides I used to put up in my investment deck was, what's the thing that British people hate to talk about? And then the next slide had the word sex with a big cross through it. And then it's like, no, not that one, the other one. It's money. There is a lot of hesitancy in a lot of homes about talking about money. And this idea that you have to hide it from children or you have to protect them from financial concerns. And actually, to have open conversations about money, to talk with your kids about good money habits and to involve them in family discussions in an age-appropriate way can make a huge difference. And, you know, that might be simply when you go to the supermarket, having the conversation about, oh, look at the big brand name at the eye level on the supermarket and how much is that for the baked beans? And now let's look at the supermarket own brand three shelves down and look at the price of that. You know, it's getting that awareness of money into the conversation. And then whenever I'm asked for tips, even if I'm asked for one single tip, the one tip I will give is give your child regular pocket money. Doesn't matter how much, it really doesn't. If you haven't got much money, then it doesn't have to be much, even if it's 20p or 50 pence a week. But give them pocket money every week. Pick a day that works for you every week so that they know they're going to be getting that money in every week, and then let them make the decisions with it. Even when they do something that you don't think is very wise with it. An example I've trotted out many times is my daughter, when she was about 13, disappearing off down our little high street with her friend, with her Go Henry card, of course, and coming back absolutely delighted, the two of them giggling and carrying on. She had bought 23 bottles of nail varnish. She already had 20-something bottles upstairs, but no, they were delighted. They were painting half a nail, different colours, you know, they were having a ball. They'd all been reduced to 50 pence in a bargain bucket in Superdrug, and they were delighted. And I was just thinking, you're crazy. You know, you've just wasted £13 something, whatever it was, on nail varnish you don't need. But I managed to keep my mouth zipped. And later that night, a friend phoned up and said, did she want to go to the movies, the cinema, the next day? And it was incredibly hard for me as a mum to do this. But I said to her, oh, do you have enough money on your card? And her face dropped. And I said, oh, well, no, but you know, you've had a lovely time with your nail varnish and you've got those for a long while now. Off she went upstairs, very obviously really upset and disappointed. But about half an hour later, she came downstairs and she said, Mum, how much do you pay those men to clean your car? And you can see where this is going. And I said, £12, but inside and out. And I usually tip them and make it 15. And she said, if I cleaned your car for you tomorrow, would you pay me £12? And I thought, do you know what? I absolutely will. And did. And of course, she got to go to the movies. But the fact that it was hard as a mum not to just go in my pocket and pull out a £10 note or transfer some money to her. But it made her think about the consequences of decisions and learning about, do I want to save some of my money for other stuff or do I want to blow it all? And that applies whether it's 50 pence or, in her case, 26 bottles.
I think it's just genius.
Oh, nail varnish. She's 25 now. She's probably still got some of them. But yeah, that is my absolute top tip, is give them a regular amount of money and let them make the decisions, because that's how they learn the delayed gratification. They learn to start save. They learn to think about those decisions and weigh them up.
There's so much power in that example that you shared, because I think exactly as you describe, I'm sure most parents across the country, and often you'll have with children when they, if they think, well, Mom's going to say no, so I'll ask Dad or whatever. But you know, your daughter's resourcefulness, I can imagine her brain ticking over and going, well, I really want to go to the cinema. But that level of determination that would then see her through in other scenarios in her life, I'm sure, as she became an adult and now, I'm sure. But also for you as a parent in, you know, the lesson, and, you know, you don't want to make everything a teachable moment, but there are certain moments of truth that you have, aren't there, as parents, when you're like, oh gosh, I really want to teach them something, but is it just easier to just hand over the cash? And actually, you know, the outcome there, it was just brilliant. So there really is something about, and actually there was a study that I saw quite recently that showed that, you know, children that are paid pocket money on a regular basis have something like a 25% higher financial literacy rate. It might be even higher than that, than those that don't. So exactly as you describe, it's not even about the amount. It's about the principle of them having and being able to assert a level of financial independence that they wouldn't otherwise have. And then separately, your point about talking to children in an age-appropriate manner at home, because again, the conversations that we think we have to shroud in secrecy, which could also include sex. And it's so funny when you said that, because as soon as you started that, I was like, I bet she's going to say sex. But I'm sure there are so many of us that think, oh, well, I can't talk about that. And of course, there are a number of different reasons, you know, based on your culture or religion, et cetera, that might, you know, preclude you from having very open conversations. But it is important that we're able to speak about topics that might otherwise be viewed as taboo. And money is always a red herring, isn't it? Because I think people just assume, well, you should know. I don't have to tell you. You should just know about money. But why would we know necessarily?
I don't know why we would assume that. I really don't.
Okay. So then in thinking about what children themselves want to learn, because we know that there are, you know, a Bank of England study last year, so in 2023, showed that even kids want to be taught how to better handle their cash. What sorts of things do you hear from GoHenry customers? Because I imagine you're talking to them all the time, or they're sending you feedback and ideas. What kinds of things do they tell you about what they're most interested in?
It's always fascinating. Yes, we are talking to our customers the whole time.
I'd love to hear some of those combos. I can imagine they're really entertaining.
There are some amazing conversations, actually. And we regularly release what we call the Youth Economy Report, where we look at the financial behaviours of our customers. And our last Youth Economy Report, it looked at the data, the financial behaviours of nearly 750,000 UK children and teens. So this is not a survey of kids. You know, it is the most comprehensive research of its kind. The last one that we did, it was really interesting. It was as it covered the period where we'd gone into the cost of living crisis. So the whole idea of money being in short supply, things going up increasingly in price, financial pressure in many, many households in the UK. That really came through, but actually in a really, really positive way. And it showed that the empowerment, the increasing financial freedom of the kids, I think the way we termed it was that it was starting to put the bank of mum and dad out of business. And some of the data behind that, we were looking at Gen Z and Gen Alpha kids. And more than half of UK parents said they were unable to contribute to their children's financial futures. What we saw was young people really taking those matters into their own hands and saving more than ever for some of life's major milestones. So when we asked 16 to 18 year olds about whether they expected their parents to help provide them with financial help, about one in five said no, they didn't. Almost three quarters of young people did not expect their parents to help pay for a wedding. Similar figure, 72% did not expect parents to help them buy a house. And 64% didn't expect parents to help foot the bill for university or training or apprenticeship. So it really was interesting to see how thinking had progressed and actually thinking and behavior, because what we saw was a real uplift in the amount of money that kids were saving. And that's kids. And when I say kids, I'm generalizing there. I mean, all the way from 6 to 18, how much they were saving and how often those savings goals were linked to big life goals. So not a pair of shoes, but university. Or actually, we had a case study from an amazing little boy who he said he in lockdown, he got addicted to watching Homes Under the Hammer with his dad. And he's saving up to buy a house. He wants to buy a buy-to-let house, and he has got a savings goal on GoHenry. He is saving up to buy a house. Yeah, that's amazing.
And what do you think has accounted for that shift? Do you think that it's more open-mindedness, around more awareness perhaps of the younger generation with regard to how realistic it is to depend on the bank of mum and dad? Or, you know, what do you think it is that's making them feel more financially independent?
I think it's two things. Number one is kids are more connected than they've ever been. You know, many, many, many of them have their phone with them. If they don't have their phone, they have a family tablet, an iPad or something like that at home that they access information on. And so, like it or not, as parents, they are seeing what's going on in the world. And we're not always able to frame what they're seeing or how they're seeing it. So they are very connected to the cost of living crisis. You know, they're hearing what the press is saying and reporting. So I think that's one aspect of it. And then I would say that the other aspect is, obviously, we were talking to Youth Economy Report. We were talking to GoHenry Kids. They have the tool in their hands that lets them do that easily. So they can set up savings goals. They are prompted to think about, are they spending it all today or are they saving some of it for tomorrow? And why saving some of it for tomorrow might be a good idea. Not in a heavy-handed way, but just teaching those, nudging those saving disciplines. It's probably the two angles that have helped to drive the shift.
And I love the idea of those nudges as well, because ultimately what you are, the biggest gift that they get as a result of being GoHenry customers is that agency, you know, that self-advocacy, the ability to really, you know, decide to choose for themselves, to feel the impact. Because, you know, as parents, we absorb a lot of the impact of, you know, some of their terrible decisions. But, you know, with their GoHenry card that, you know, once, you know, the money's been topped up and they're making decisions themselves, exactly as you described in the example with your daughter, you know, they're able to go, oh gosh, well, that was a mistake, wasn't it? Now, you know, I'm not going to do that in future. I'm going to try something else. Or if I know that I want to buy the 20 bottles of nail polish and go to the cinema, then that will require me to generate an additional source of income. So that's another skill that they are learning, another muscle that they're flexing as a result of being, you know, part of the GoHenry community, which is just incredible. So when we think then, you know, outside the UK, and, you know, a recent study showed that the UK is 15th out of 29 OECD countries for financial literacy, which is wild, given, you know, when you think of the UK as kind of a global hotspot for financial services. Is there anywhere in the world that you think is getting it right when it comes to investing in children's financial literacy?
That's a really good question. I am not an expert on financial education globally. I'm mm-hmm. really not. My focus is very strongly UK with a little bit of the US thrown in because we've operated in the US since 2018. But what I can tell you is across Europe, there are a lot of different approaches to financial education for young people. There are some countries where it's not systematically addressed at all. And then there are others where financial literacy is integrated into the curriculum from a really early age. The countries that always score very highly in the financial literacy rankings are the Nordic countries, so Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and they all have a comprehensive financial education program integrated into the school curriculum, and it focuses on practical money management skills as well as some of the broader economic concepts. And I think that, you know, it's one of the conversations we've had with government is, you know, if you want an example of what can be achieved, look at those countries, because we can see that it works. You know, we can see that their scores, financial literacy scores, are higher than ours. And frankly, that's why we want it to be prioritised in all UK schools.
And so thinking about this pincer movement then between the practicality around the financial education component from a theoretical standpoint, coupled with proactively, you know, whether it's giving children pocket money or just, you know, setting up a savings account for them. In the UK, we know we've had a number of state-led initiatives or interventions, you know, to help almost provide the catalyst for children's savings. So we've now got junior ISAs, which we've come off the back of child trust funds. And so for anybody that's listening outside the UK, effectively what we had with child trust funds was every eligible UK child had or was able to get access to £250 in a savings account, a government approved savings account, which their parents and other family members could then top up on their behalf. And then those accounts would mature when they reached 18, which I think was a brilliant initiative. What is your view on state-led initiatives like that to help parents start saving for their kids? Do you think it's a helpful initiative? Do you think that it hampers, you know, families doing their own thing for their children? What's your view?
Overall, I do think it's helpful. I mean, the Child mm-hmm. Trust Fund has gone. That was closed several years ago.
Yeah.
And I have to say there's a huge amount of them that have been lost. They're still there, but parents have lost track of them or forgotten about them. But we do have the junior ISA, and I think that is a valuable incentive for parents to save for their children's future. You know, it promotes financial education, it promotes long-term planning, it promotes building up assets, building wealth over the long term. And the more we can do to surface that and make sure that every parent is aware of it and aware of, you know, putting away money little and often can build into a really worthwhile sum over a period of time. But I'm going to say any sort of savings initiative needs to be part of a comprehensive financial plan that teaches the children themselves as well about budgeting, about those savings habits and responsible money management.
Yeah, completely agree. And actually, for anybody that might have, you know, as Louise has correctly outlined, you know, child trust funds are legacy accounts now, but there are a lot of people that still have those accounts out there. So if you are listening and think that you might have a dormant account somewhere, or your child might have because someone else has set one up for them, then it's definitely worth it. It's a bit like your pension. It's a bit like those dormant pensions that we have that need tracking down as well. So Louise, I was really excited to see that GoHenry was acquired by Acorns, because I remember, you know, when I first started thinking about the business that I wanted Raincheck to become and the mission that I wanted to pursue in terms of the challenge I wanted to resolve, it was really firmly rooted in financial inclusion. So I hadn't yet got to the stage of niching down into, you know what, it's not just financial inclusion for everyone. I want to think about women specifically. And Acorns was one of the businesses that I looked at, and I really loved their offering. So massive congratulations, because I'm sure it must have been, you know, what we see is, you know, the headlines and it sounds amazing, but, you know, there's so much that must go. I mean, even when you describe the pitching process of trying to raise funding for GoHenry in the early days, and I can just imagine what that looked like. What has been one of the toughest things about not just bringing GoHenry to life, but, you know, in terms of finding a suitable partner with whom you could collaborate? So, you know, how did that come about in terms of your decision to, I suppose, work with Acorns? Because, you know, it's not just you walking away. You are still very much involved.
I am still very much involved. Yes, absolutely. That's a really good question. Do you know, yes, you talked about what you see on the surface and then what the truth of that is underneath. It was actually, it's almost exactly a year ago, the 3rd of April last year, when we completed the deal with Acorns and became part of a wider group. But the process started 2.5 years before that. And actually, it was one of Acorns' investment funds, Greycroft, who introduced the two of us. And we started talking. And really, I guess you could see from the outside appearance of the two businesses, but our missions were so closely aligned that it was like meeting a kindred spirit. Acorns was set up, for those who don't know, Acorns was set up just over 10 years ago in the US with a single mission to introduce easy, accessible investing in a simple way to what they termed the everyday American. So not wealthy individuals in some oak-paneled stateroom somewhere, but normal people like us. And they launched with very simple investing strategies, like a dollar a day, round up your spend and put the extra pennies into your investment account, earn cash back and the money goes into your investment account. But the whole mantra was put a little bit away, put it away regularly, stick with it, do not day trade, just little and often, and it will build. And the whole imagery of Acorns is built around planting your acorn and growing your mighty oak.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's really visual imagery and it really works. And they were building out their offering. They have a huge number of American customers, only based in the US at that point in time. And they'd built out retirement savings with Acorns Later, the equivalent of a junior ISA, a US UGMA called Acorns Early, saving for your kids. But what they didn't have was a family's offering. And in reverse order, GoHenry had spent 10 years bringing in funds and different investment rounds and growing like crazy and always being challenged on, but you let your customer base drop off the end when they reach 18. What are you going to do about 18 plus? So when we started talking, it just made huge sense to bring the two brands together and be able to offer the same simple, easy access, low cost financial education, but by providing really practical tools to customers regardless of their life stage. So it doesn't matter whether you're a 22-year-old singleton or a 28-year-old, I'm making huge assumptions here, but, you know, 28-year-old living with a partner, somebody buying a house, a young couple with a young child, a young couple with teenagers, somebody saving for their retirement. Doesn't matter. Between Acorns and GoHenry, we have the products and the services to meet their needs. And that's been the big excitement. That was the propulsion behind coming together. And the excitement over the last year has been starting to bring that to life.
Yeah, it's so exciting. And I love what you shared about that kind of whole of life, because from my perspective, of course, GoHenry is a proposition is so powerful, and the numbers speak for themselves. It's such a powerful offering, such an engaging offering as well for parents and children, which I think it can be a difficult thing to do, because I think often, I mean, I remember being a child and you know, my mom, you know, when you're going through puberty as a young woman, and then, you know, your parents, I come from a very classically Caribbean household. So no one's really going to have a proactive conversation with me about sex or boobs or periods or anything like that. So, you know, one day, you know, I went up to my bedroom and there was just a book on the bed. And I think the book was called Growing Pains. And the thing is, I mean, I read the book, and my mom then got one of my older cousins to come, and she did not have a conversation with me, but she recruited one of my older cousins to come and have a chat with Dav about the contents of the book. And I just remember saying, you know, and I was so glad that she'd got my cousin to do that, because it was so boring. I remember flicking through it and going, this is so dry, it's so boring. And so what Go Henry has been able to do so well is to really straddle these, I mean, effectively disparate groups, you know, parents and children, and make it engaging across different ages. But then, you know, partnering with Acorns and having this whole of life experience of being able to reach people, you know, whatever the life milestone is amazing. And as you say, you know, will propel you to the next stage and really help you to reach millions more, which is amazing. I love it. Two brilliant businesses, truly.
Thank you.
So Louise, just as we come to the end of our conversation, and I'm sure people will be really keen to know this, can we talk about your personal relationship with money and where you learned how to manage money and I guess some of your highs and lows over time?
Yeah, I had a Saturday job from the age of 13.
Where did you work, Louise?
I was a washer-upper, but only allowed to do the cutlery. Didn't graduate to crockery at the YMCA in Lowestoft, where I grew up. And I was paid...
Brilliant. I worked at Hush Puppies. Okay.
So again, dating myself, I earned 63 pence an hour. I distinctly remember.
Wow.
One of my really strong memories about that was saving up for ages to buy a Laura Ashley skirt.
Oh gosh, remember Laura Ashley? Wow.
Oh my God. I'm surprised. Yeah. They were all the rage at the time. And there was a department store in town with a very trendy boutique in one corner of it. And I saved for ages for that skirt and went with my friend, my next door neighbor, Emma, downtown to go and buy the skirt, and just had a total crisis of confidence and was too intimidated by the incredibly glamorous shop assistants in the boutique to try one on. We sort of went in and went very red and confused looking and left. And I went home and burst into tears and told my mum. And bless her, I remember her sort of patiently saying to me that I needed to remember that if the department, it was a department store called Tuttle's, if Tuttle's didn't have customers, those young ladies wouldn't have a job. So that if I was buying something, I was paying their wages. So they would actually want me in the boutique. And bless her, she drove us back into town and sat in the car whilst Emma and I went in and bought the skirt. And yeah, I was very, very proud of it. I wore it to the school disco, dark brown. It was tiered, dark brown, orange and beige.
That's
flowers
brilliant.
And crocheted lace panels. Because it was, you know, it was the 70s.
I love that. And it just, I mean, it's testament to the role of parents as well in scooping us up off the floor and saying, no, it's okay, try again. So Louise, my final question then, we think about wealth overall, and this is a podcast about wealth, but we know that wealth manifests itself in a variety of different ways. What does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you?
The first thing to say is wealth when applied to money, I really struggle with the word wealth used in that sense, because I feel it excludes people. And I think that's partly been my experience. I think people believe that it means rich. And so it doesn't apply to them. You know, if I think back, I didn't even think about investing until a few years ago. And I really do mean sort of 5, 6, 7 years ago. And when I saw a wealth manager, I always thought, well, that's not me, because I'm not wealthy.
It's for other people.
It's for other people. It's not for me. And that is simply not the case. So I'd love wealth management to be renamed money management, so that it's more obvious that it's for everyone, every single one of us. But to answer your question, a wealthy woman, for me, I wouldn't list money in probably the top 2 or 3 things that I'd put on my list. And I hope this doesn't sound corny, but family and friends, having family and friends around you to love and to be loved.
Not at all.
I think that's to be wealthy, to have your health, to have a purpose in life. And 9 times out of 10, that comes from loving family and friends and being there for family and friends. And then money comes into it, because to have enough money to allow you to make choices. And to me, a lot of that is about what being confident with money means, being able to plan ahead and choose how you spend your money and how you spend your time.
I love that. I often say, you know, it's so powerful when we recognize that money is a tool that can open up choices and options for us, but that real wealth comes from, you know, being able to manage your own day and to, you know, be in control of your own time, as well as all of the other things that you've said, the abundance that comes from really strong and loving family relationships and friendships, etc. So Louise, thank you so, so much for your time today. You know, I always say this, but I feel that, you know, I could fill another hour in conversation. Where can people find you, connect with you if they would like to, and also sign up to the brilliant Go Henry?
Yeah, really easy. If you go to gohenry.com, you will find us. And if people are looking for me, they can find me on LinkedIn.
Brilliant. Louise, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.